Hi, Alex.
Hey, Adam.
And hello, everyone.
Hello.
Welcome to Liver Talks, a long overdue episode of Liver Talks, but here we are.
Yeah.
I'd say official podcast of the Liver Fellow Network.
Mm-hmm.
And
the only podcast of the Liver Fellow Network
that we know of.
That's true.
Yeah, and we've got a really good episode today, I think.
Yes. We certainly do. But before getting there, you know, you're now an actual transplant hepatology fellow. And we decided to give you off the end of July from an episode and give all of us off for the end of July. But how's it been going so far?
It's going well. It's really nice to be doing the thing that you wanted to do and it took 6 years to do.
And that's field overnight transfer calls?
Yeah, listen, sometimes you just need to develop a relationship with every fellow in the greater New York area. And this is a job that lets you do that.
That's
and
perfect.
So I'm really glad to have it.
Yeah.
But no, it's just nice to like, I don't know, I feel like the reason I got into hepatology mm-hmm. is because I saw a transplant as a medical student.
Mm.
And then you go a long time without seeing that or at least being that close to it. And then to be able to do it again or be part of it is kind of cool. So it's just nice to be doing the thing that you want to do. And I've enjoyed it so far. And yeah, it's busy and it's difficult, but it's rewarding. And so hopefully for anyone out there considering, you know, going into transplant hepatology, should do it.
Yeah. And I know people are starting to send out their letters of interest for transplant hepatology fellowship, which we will also be talking about with our interview in a second.
Yes.
But if you have either questions for me, who went through the process last year, or Adam as someone who now is a transplant hepatology fellow, feel free to slide into either or both of our DMs on Twitter.
Yes, please slide right into our DMs.
Because it's definitely the most opaque of the processes. There's no match. There's no sort of clear apparatus for applications. So we're happy to talk about our experiences, which is an N of two. But and we both ended up at the same place. But if you want a very specific experience, please reach out to us.
Yeah, it's definitely an odd process. But as I'm learning now, finding a job is also an odd process.
Mm-hmm.
So the constraints or sort of the linear bowling with bumpers process of the match will not be there the rest of your life. So, you know, it's good to get used to a little bit of discomfort.
Yes.
Well said.
We will certainly have an episode in the future talking about the job search once it has been locked down, as it were.
Yes. Absolutely. And but for now.
Yes. For now, we have a great episode. So we have an incredible interview with Dr. Adam Michalajczyk.
The better Adam.
The different Adam. A slightly wiser Adam, perhaps. And we're talking about a variety of things, including application season. And he has some really good advice in terms of what to look for in a program for a GI fellowship or a transplant hepatology fellowship. And then we talk about his recent paper looking at hepatology training of residents and how that sort of affects their interest in going into hepatology. So I think it's a lot of topics we really like and was a very worthwhile episode. And then we have a bumping freestyle segment today talking about my recent paper in DDS. It relates to love languages.
Love.
And for those that have been wondering what Adam's love languages are, you're going to have to wait till the third segment. But without further ado, our interview with Dr. Adam Michalajczyk. We are thrilled to have Dr. Adam Michalajczyk on the podcast today. He is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Illinois College of Medicine and a practicing transplant hepatologist. He is one of the associate program directors for the internal medicine residency there and the lead faculty advisor for the Liver Fellow Network. Dr. Michalajczyk, thank you so much for making time to come on the pod.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. It's quite an honor.
Well, this podcast wouldn't exist without you, so the honor is mutual. So before getting to the things that we want to talk about today, we were hoping that you might just be able to give our listeners a little overview of your practice.
Sure. So I would say I'm primarily clinical. Mm-hmm. So I do 1 to 2 transplant hepatology clinics a week. I have 2 general hepatology clinics a week. I have 1 endoscopy block. And then from an inpatient side, I do about 3 months of inpatient service as well. So predominantly clinical, and then the remainder of that time is built out for my academic activities.
Awesome. So a number of things that are happening right now make you the perfect guest to have on. And the first is that we are in application season and interview season, I should say. And that's both for gastroenterology fellowship and then also transplant hepatology fellowships. And as Adam Winters will hopefully talk to us about in a few months, also actual job interview and application season. So that's exciting as well. But as someone who works closely with residents, but then also with fellows, you're sort of uniquely positioned to comment on these different sort of stages of applications. And so we thought we might start by talking about GI fellowship writ large. And I think the same ideas sort of play into transplant hepatology as well. But unlike medical school or residency, where you're sort of applying to a bunch of places, but they're more or less designed to be fairly similar experiences, fellowship is to some extent the first time where the experience you have at a given place is different than, you know, X other program. And so there's more of a need, or there should at least be a thought about bidirectional fit. And so we were curious, as someone who's on the attending side of a fellowship, what types of questions or what types of things should applicants be thinking about when determining if a given program is a good fit?
It's a fantastic question, and I completely agree with that. That, you know, with fellowship, really any application process, but certainly with fellowship, you want to be asking mm-hmm. yourself, where are you going to thrive? And which institution and which program are going to provide me personally the opportunities where I will thrive? And all of your questions should really be centered around that. And this concept of thriving, I think, has three aspects to it: clinical, academic, and personal. So from a clinical standpoint, pretty straightforward. If you're interested in hepatology, you know, what is the clinical exposure to hepatology? If you're interested in inflammatory bowel disease, what types of experiences do you have related to that? How much scoping do you offer, et cetera? Mm-hmm. So those are easy questions. I think the academic ones are a little more tough, and that's where this fit really starts to come into play. What do you see your career trajectory looking like, and will that institution be able to support you along that trajectory? And some questions that you really want to ask are, you know, a very simple one is, asking the faculty member, what attracted you to this institution? What keeps you here? That's going to give them, they're going to give their story of how they ended up there and what's kept them there. What are those values of the department, of the institution, that have allowed them to, you know, kind of build their career at that particular place? You also want to get a sense of where you're going moving forward. So, you know, where have other fellows gone who have trained at this institution? What types of activities have they participated in? What have their careers looked like? Gives you an idea of kind of the longitudinal aspect of going through this training program. And finally, you know, from a personal standpoint, and I think a lot of times, I really want to stress this because I think a lot of times we put so much emphasis on the first two. What's the clinical training going to look like? What is the academic environment going to be? Will my research interests be supported? Whatever those may be. And then we kind of let the personal fall to the back burner. And, you know, at the end of the day, no matter what institute, we're blessed to be able to have all these great institutions to choose from and all these awesome interview opportunities. But sometimes that personal side of things is really what makes that fit crystallize for folks. You know, asking what people do outside of work, how much work do you bring home on a day-to-day basis, getting a sense of work-life balance at the institution and how much they value that. What are some wellness initiatives that your program will implement, especially during the past pandemic? You know, how have things been? What has the institution done to try and support you through that? I think a lot of those things really can make the difference between a good experience and an amazing experience, especially trying to find a place where you feel happiest, not just in terms of the people that you're working with, but then also the location. you know, being in an area of the country that you want to be in. Because at the end of the day, like I said, you'll get great training at a lot of these institutions. But if you're miserable outside of work, then the fit's probably not going to be right.
I think that is very good advice. And I think that it's easier to suffer in silence or quasi-silence the earlier in the career, because your life may not be as built up around you, but certainly once you get to the fellowship stage, it's important to think about what it means for you and potentially other members of your family as well. And I know it played a large role in me coming to Boston, where I had both my now spouse and sister. One thing you touched on that I'm always curious and I would love your thoughts on is, so for people that really do think they're interested in hepatology or transplant hepatology, is, you know, do you think it's important to be at a place that really has a very, very robust transplant program or a huge hepatology presence? Or is there potentially a role for almost picking a place that shines in all areas of GI because it's your only time to sort of be exposed to it? Where do you fall on that spectrum?
I think I fall on the spectrum of, you know, our first priority is to become a great gastroenterologist. Mm-hmm. You know, just like, you know, before we went into fellowship, our first priority was to become a great internist. Mm-hmm. And you want to become a great endoscopist. You want to understand all facets of gastroenterology. And I think having the most well-rounded experience possible is the best one. I don't think you have to, you know, see large amounts of hepatology in your first 2 to 3 years of training to really become an amazing hepatologist. You have the rest of your life to do that. It's really meant to get that great foundation to build upon. One thing I like to really use as an example is, so I did my fellowship at the University of Chicago, and mm-hmm. They have a very strong GI nutrition program. We have that institution has a nutrition fellowship, actually. We get a ton of exposure to TPN, more so than I think a lot of other gastroenterology fellowships. And at first glance, you would think, oh, you know, I'm interested in hepatology, and, you know, how does that really overlap with nutrition? And almost daily, I rely upon that training in nutrition as a hepatologist, as I'm approaching patients who are frail, malnourished, thinking about, you know, what are they doing in terms of fat-soluble vitamins, et cetera. And so it really formed a solid foundation for me that I've been able to build upon as a hepatologist.
That's all very good advice. Thank you. So switching gears to recruiting or having more hepatologists, as we talked about at length in a previous podcast with Dr. Oren Fix, we are looking down the barrel of a massive shortage of hepatologists moving forward, both due to not having that many hepatologists and there being projected to be a real explosion in chronic liver disease in patients that would benefit from a liver specialist or at least someone specially trained in some amount of liver. And so to that end, you had a recent paper that was published in Hepatology Communications titled Mandatory Hepatology Education for Internal Medicine Residents, Long-Term Effects and Implications for Workforce Needs, which was fascinating, and I highly recommend everybody read. It's a good read, too. It's not a slog. but you helped to create a inpatient hepatology rotation with some didactics associated with it for internal medicine residents. And as best I could tell, the goals were both to improve comfort and knowledge with the treatment of chronic liver disease, but also potentially increase interest in pursuing a career in hepatology by being exposed in a very immersive way. Could you start by just talking a little bit about your inspiration for the project and what you think the main findings were?
Of course. Thank you for that question. So from a inspiration standpoint, I can tell you exactly the moment at which I was inspired to do this project. It was when I was a third year resident. I was in the ICU. I was on overnight call and I had a decompensated cirrhotic and admitted to the ICU. And up until that point, I had had pretty minimal exposure to chronic liver disease. And I can remember being just beside myself as to how to manage this patient and not understanding the physiology. And it dawned on me that I had gone through the majority of residency with very little exposure to chronic liver disease. And I recognized that that was an issue, and that was an issue that I wanted to change. And that honestly has been the impetus for all of my research kind of moving forward in my career in terms of, you know, being focused on medical education within hepatology. We initially had done a pilot study a few years back that was published in Hepatology. Similar concept in terms of the curriculum was the same, mm-hmm. Designed to be a mandatory experience. And we assessed the outcomes after that rotation, immediately after. So once the rotation was over at the 2-week mark, we assessed the outcomes. And in that study, career interest did increase. And so then the follow-up question was, in a much more longitudinal way, do we see the career interest being permanent or more long-lasting? And what we saw in the second follow-up study is that both the comfort and knowledge was much more permanent and long-lasting, which was awesome, and we were super excited about that. But the career interest did seem to wane as time went on, which I think really calls to the fact that, yes, we can spark this interest, but then we need to do something else about it. Because at the same time, when somebody does a cardiology rotation, they're probably going to be really excited about that, or rheumatology or whatever it may be. And then you're going to lose people
or
along
not.
The way. Yeah, exactly. And then you'll lose people along the way.
That makes a lot of sense. So to that end, about it sort of being an inspiring experience, but then whether or not they can sort of change trajectory or have that be, their career moving forward. What was striking to me was that the majority of the people that did the rotation were third year residents. And so there's some thought in my mind that maybe it was too late for them to be able to sort of say, oh, I really want to become a hepatologist. Do you think that an earlier experience, especially as maybe an intern or early second year resident, would have made a difference in this outcome? And are there any efforts to sort of change when people are exposed to this?
It's a fantastic question, and one I've wondered as well. So I completely agree that at that point it may be too late. And if you're not GI bound at that point, yes, I like liver, but hey, it's not going to change the overall trajectory of my career. At the end of third year, for example, and that has actually inspired some of our other work. So we have started to look into medical schools. So we did a single center study looking at career interest within hepatology within medical school, which I think largely is based upon exposure. So the first thing we were trying to define is, are medical students exposed to hepatology in the same way that they're exposed to things like CHF and COPD, and the mm-hmm. preliminary data from the single center is no, we're not even close. And so we're actually in the midst of doing a multi-center study as well, looking at this question. But once we establish that exposure is poor, then that's where there's room for intervention to hopefully show that we can then move the barometer in terms of career interest earlier, which I do think plays a big role in that.
I think one of the more interesting things from the study to me was that a lot of people felt they would be interested in hepatology alone rather than sort of eschewing the idea of doing gastroenterology first and then going into hepatology and sort of fast-tracking the experience. Do you think that a primary care plus type model would bridge the gap between the much-needed providers for liver disease and those that are currently available?
I definitely do. I think that's a very viable, type of option. I've actually had the experience of being able to work with individuals who are hospitalists, for example, that have that type of focus where they want to almost become a liver hospitalist and mm-hmm. build their career around that. And I think that's absolutely amazing. And another solution to this workforce issue that we are experiencing. And our curriculum is really designed for those individuals as well. So it's not necessarily designed to produce hepatologists. It's really just designed to produce internists who have comfort and familiarity with liver disease so that they are comfortable co-managing. And if at the end of the day, we can produce more co-managers, then it definitely was a success.
Yeah, I mean, oncology has done this, right? I mean, there's the concept of the onco hospitalist. So why can't we have the the hepatologist oncologist or the hepatologist hospitalist or something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Nailed it.
You know, close enough.
Hepatopolis.
Well, we've all worked with plenty of hepatologists.
We'll keep workshopping it.
Scope. So, I mean, you know.
We'll keep working on the name.
In terms of the actual curriculum side of it, if there are other institutions that are interested in sort of adapting this to their locations, is there a way to get these didactics or collaborate with you on them?
Yeah, so certainly. You know, we essentially just created a library of articles, a core set of topics. Really, the biggest thing is just faculty buy-in. So having faculty members who are committed to giving, kind of informal or formal, didactics on the topics of the core curriculum. That was kind of the most difficult part, is just getting everybody to buy into the model. But certainly, all of the materials are be more than happy to share with anybody interested in implementing something comparable.
So the last thing we wanted to talk about is you, or specifically your path. You've managed to be a successful clinician educator. So we're curious what advice you would have for trainees or those who are maybe junior faculty as to how to best succeed as an educator, where it seems like, the clinician educator role is maybe harder to come by or harder to progress through or through a promotional track or, things like that.
Yes, it's a great question. I would say, the first thing to think about is just become a very strong clinician. And if you have a passion for teaching and education, that will come second nature. Put yourself in a clinical environment where you're surrounded by trainees and the teaching will follow. But first, you want to make sure that you know the material really well. And so those first few years are really just going to be focused on understanding the clinical side of things and reading on your own to further your own knowledge. And that passion then will kind of come forward. And then as time goes on and you feel more comfortable with the subject matter that you're practicing and you're teaching on, that's when you really start to refine your teaching skill. And so being very introspective kind of acquiring as much feedback from your learners as you possibly can to refine your technique. At the end of a didactic, did that work? What did you think? Something I could change at the end of the rotation. I would always ask, the residents or fellows, how did you feel about how I presented that material? Always trying to just refine your teaching skill to get it better and better as time goes on. And then that will allow you to really start to establish yourself as someone who is passionate at education and then hopefully maybe okay at it, doing an okay job. And as that occurs, then your institution will recognize that is a priority for you. And they will then start to identify opportunities that could become available for you, recognizing that is your career path that you're interested in.
How do you translate that into, or how do you account for kind of your productivity in like the educational setting? For obviously you publish papers, but for a lot of people who maybe aren't doing as much research out of it, how do you account for the time that you spend as an educator and get recognized for that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It is much more difficult just because it is a little bit more of an atypical path. What I would say is, one, so if there are any opportunities to be able to get some advanced training in medical education, if you really are serious about the path, I think that helps a lot. So for example, I did a medical education fellowship during my chief residency year. And not only was it one of the most formative things I've ever done in my career in terms of it really kind of altered my change in my trajectory from being a clinical researcher to more of a medical educator, it also taught me how to approach medical education in a very systematic, scientific way. And that way, whenever you are creating a new curriculum or thinking about a education project in a new and novel way, trying to understand how to assess it, so then you could create something that becomes productive. And so that's where the research side of it does come out. And it doesn't have to be, a multi-center survey or, a 4-year longitudinal study. It could be something that is much more simple that becomes a research letter. It could be a letter to the editor. You know, just identifying what is appropriate for that scenario, but trying to take your efforts and maximize them into something that does carry a little bit of, you know, kind of weight within academic currency, if you will.
Should we go to the lightning round, Alex? Do you have anything else?
I guess we'll go to the lightning round. It's time. We got to give the people what they want. Well, thank you very much. I found this to be a very, very interesting conversation, and one that I think there are some tangible pieces of advice, both from the beginning and end, for anybody that's listening, if they're a trainee or young professional, which we continue to assume is most of the people that aren't related to us that are listening, and then some interesting thoughts as to how to recruit more people into hepatology moving forward. Without further ado, let's move to the lightning round. Adam, you want to take the first question?
Sure. Have we retired the favorite liver cell question yet?
No. But that's always the last question.
It's been a minute. So what is a either TV show or book that you've read most recently?
I'll go with a TV show.
Okay.
There's an embarrassing one.
There's an incredible
David Goldberg. So yeah. Dr. Tapper. That's right. Yeah.
Or no. Yeah. Yeah. Naked that's and Afraid right. So was Dr. Goldberg.
I think you should have feel this is a safe space.
Yes.
Okay. So honestly, the most recent TV show that I've been watching with my wife is Bachelorette.
Yes. Can't go wrong with that on the show.
And most recently, Bachelor in Paradise just started. So we've my wife and I have been watching that at night when
a
the
real
kids
citizen
are
of the nation.
Excellent. Well, not to get too into the weeds with this, but it is remarkable that the most marriages have come out of Bachelor in Paradise and not either The Bachelor or Bachelorette. So
yes.
I've got something going for it. Or there's just fundamental flaws with dating 25 people at the same time. Yeah. Well, my only recommendation, we just finished both seasons of Never Have I Ever, and I highly recommend it to everybody.
That's another one. We're actually at the very end of the second season. So
fantastic.
Also very good. Yep.
Yes. So our second question is, when has there been a time in your career where luck played a role?
These are good questions here.
Equally serious.
There's been a lot of times when luck has played a role. Let me think. I've mentioned it before, but having done the medical education fellowship, mm-hmm. And really falling into that experience, that's not something that I started resident. That wasn't even on my radar, from a residency standpoint, and just being involved with people who are interested in medical education over those years, and recommending that it be an opportunity to think about, I think was lucky in the fact that I didn't see it coming and I didn't actively seek it out, and it really just ultimately changed my course of my career.
All right, and do you like deep dish pizza?
I do, but I actually like a thin crust better. I like a thin crust better.
Yeah, the follow-up question is deep dish pizza pizza?
You don't have to answer that.
Or is it just a cheese pie?
It is. I would go more with the cheese pie, to be honest. If I were going to do it with the thin crust folded over, That's actually how I like
this man
it.
In New York.
I shouldn't be saying that in Chicago, but I know. I was going to say it's I shouldn't be saying that in Chicago, but that's the way I would eat it.
All right. And what is your favorite liver cell?
So I think I would go with a hepatocyte, the industrious cell of the liver, and I admire all of its hard work. And then, the AST and the ALT are kind of like little breadcrumbs that they leave out. Certain ratio will lead you one way versus another way. And I'm intrigued by those breadcrumbs, trying to follow that trail, get to the ending. So.
Well, I think that's a great place to end it. Thank you very, very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
All right. Well, that was Adam Mikolajczyk. And now it's just Alex and I.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be talking love languages.
That's right. I can't help but notice your voice got a lot lower there.
I know. Well, we should play that music in the background when we edit it.
That's on you.
Okay, that's fine. I'll do it. And the reason we're going to be doing that is because Alex published a paper in Digestive
against
Diseases Sciences Against All Odds. Thank you. Shout out to Editor-in-Chief Jonathan Kaunitz from UCLA.
Thank you.
Yeah. He published a paper called Learning to Love Endoscopy, Lessons from the Five Love Languages about creating an optimal learning environment for endoscopic trainees. And it's a fascinating read. It's actually really interesting. And I feel like it kind of formalizes a lot of the things that I experienced getting trained in endoscopy, but puts it in like a really fun to read way. And also important for faculty, junior faculty, people who are interested in teaching endoscopy, kind of synthesizes ways that you can help trainees. Alex, why did you write this paper?
Yeah, so thank you for that warm introduction. And this was a paper I really, I'll say something that is rarely said, enjoyed writing. And I wrote it with Dr. Naveen Kumar, also of Brigham and Women's, who is a master educator, a huge figure in med ed. He's also a podcast host. He runs the Run the List podcast. And we were paired for 6 months. We have sort of 6 month periods with different endoscopists at Brigham. And so he was my endoscopy teacher. And I noticed that there were a lot of things he was doing that I found very helpful. And I had certainly at this point, I was now 1.5 years in, had been with a lot of people that didn't necessarily do things that really helped me sort of grow as an endoscopist. And what I think I was trying to distill with this paper was a set of skills that a endoscopy teacher can use to create a learning environment that is comfortable and thus allows for sort of rapid skill acquisition. Because I think the problem with endoscopy, depending on where you are, is you may be scoping with someone for one EGD ever, or you may be with someone for a year. And so the challenge as the teacher is to try to create that environment where someone feels comfortable and can learn optimally. And so these are different ways to do it, broken down by the love languages.
And so for those interested, the five love languages are... Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into that more at the end.
Acts of service.
Yeah.
Words, or so let's just actually take the moment.
Sure.
One. So acts of service, which is performing tasks usually done by the fellow when the trainer senses that the trainee is overwhelmed or behind. I mean, this is like, if you want to make a trainee happy, I mean, acts of service is just, you know, the thing to do.
Yeah. And I think the thing to remember is that, especially when it comes to skill training, the name of the game, at least in most of the research that I was able to find, is all about cognitive load. Because the second that people are off in other places or worried about other things or overwhelmed or overloaded, essentially, they can't learn well. And so it's all about just getting things done, which is not the way that you sort of do it. And so sometimes you're just sort of overwhelmed as a fellow. Your pager's been going off for the whole procedure and it wasn't an easy procedure. And now you're thinking about the pages and you've got this note to do and the consent to do. And so sometimes when a endoscopy attending just says, you know what, I'm going to finish this note, we'll meet up in the next room or once the room is cleaned, it can make a huge difference in decreasing cognitive load and allowing the person to really learn and appreciate what's going on in the procedures.
Yeah, I'm having flashbacks to my MGI fellowship. So the next love language is words of affirmation. So providing targeted feedback in real time, either during or immediately after the procedure, to highlight effective actions by the trainee.
Yes. So feedback is the number one tool for skill learning. And the key is that it needs to be in real time. Because otherwise, because skills are physical, you end up sort of wiring them into your brain as you're doing them. So if you don't get that immediate feedback, it can be hugely costly and hard to sort of reverse. And so words of affirmation is really about giving feedback in real time. Things like, you know, you got that polyp right to 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock, depending on your school of thought. That was great. Or like, wow, look at how you reduce that loop. And so you're programming in right then, giving that extra level of reinforcement so that people know, okay, what I just did was right. I should remember that sort of movement that I did.
Absolutely. All right. The next love language is quality time. Mm-hmm. Giving a trainee the time necessary to grow as an endoscopist through maximizing trainee hands-on participation.
Yes. What do you think about this one?
I think it's important to allow the training endoscopist to make their own mistakes, mm-hmm. and also be able to learn how to get over, get through a complicated process, right? Mm-hmm. So like the challenging polypectomy, the difficult turn, the narrowed or angulated sigmoid, the only way you learn to do those things is to have a faculty member, have your trainer, mm-hmm. be patient with you and get through it. And if that's not, if you're really struggling, have them show you how they do it, have them do it,
yep.
have them explain how they do it, and then immediately give the scope back
100%.
To you. So it feels like you've sort of are able to process how they did it, but then you also get the tactile sensation of having the scope back, mm-hmm. So that you can sort of, you can think about it and conceptualize it in your mind.
Yeah. And I'll just say for any teachers on listening to this, there's no problem with taking the scope away briefly if someone's really struggling, but if it's not given back pretty promptly, it immediately sort of shoots the relationship in the foot, because then a trainee is going to at least subconsciously hesitate to ask for help, because they think in future procedures, the second they ask for help once, the procedure's over for them. And so I've found that like many of the most successful relationships I've had learning endoscopy is where I can ask for that help. They'll take the scope for a second and then they immediately hand it back and are talking through what they're doing.
Right. And at least personally, once the scope is taken away from me, it kind of goes back mm-hmm. to the first love language, that my mind is kind of out of it for a little, you know what I mean? Like unless I know that it's being taken away
yeah.
for teaching, I'm sort of, I don't want to say checked out, but my mind begins to wander.
Yeah.
All right. The next love language, physical touch.
Yes.
Participating actively during the procedure in ways that help the trainee succeed through aiding with patient positioning and scope handling as needed.
Yeah. I'll say the obvious thing up front, never touch the fellow. That should just go without saying. But there are things that I've seen trainers do that are so, so helpful. And it's when you sort of help with the patient, whether it's abdominal pressure, or helping to roll the patient even before we're asking for it, so that you can see, oh, they're seeing something that means that we should be asking for pressor or trying to change position. Or if like you're clearly so tied around the scope and then they're like, oh, there's a polyp there, and they feed in the snare or the forceps, it makes such a world of difference to know that you're really on that team together. And so I highly recommend that.
And if you're the trainee,
yeah.
Early on, I felt like I was sort of, I don't know, when they had the help feed the device, I felt like maybe I was doing something wrong. But then I saw, people who I considered master endoscopists mm-hmm. asking for, the techs to help load devices. I just accept the help.
Yeah.
It makes things so much easier.
That's a really crucial point by Adam, and I couldn't agree more.
The other thing I'll say about this one,
yes.
too, is that sometimes the absence of physical touch is important. For example, I had an attending who would give pressure at times where I really didn't want it. And so I think, kind of a little bit of a tangent here, but it's okay to ask as a trainee, to not give, at a
yeah.
moment where you feel like pressure isn't required, it's okay to give that feedback, too.
I agree.
Okay. Finally, the last love language, gifts.
Yes.
When a trainer seeks out and provides the trainee with valuable endoscopic experiences outside of their normal session together.
Yeah, so this was a hard one to come up with, but once we had sort of thought about it, it made a ton of sense, because it's sort of the last level of the trainee-trainer relationship, where the trainer is so clearly trying to allow for the optimal learning experience for the trainee, and that comes when they sort of seek out other experiences for the trainee, like if they know a dilation's happening in the next room, or a banding, or there's an EMR, or something sort of cool and out of the box that's happening, and they sort of seek out the trainee to do that with them or with someone else, it really, for the trainee, means a ton, because it means that the person like genuinely cares, and it's not that they're just trying to get through their endoscopy session with you. And so it's a nice sort of cherry on top of the cake, but the other four are sort of every procedure, hopefully this kind of stuff is happening.
Yeah. And I always found myself much more receptive to people who I felt like were invested in me. And so getting that kind of late feedback or something, mm-hmm. or get being thought of, prior to a case or after a case in that way, like made me feel valued. And I think that's, it's a really important one to, really one of the important love languages to embody.
So the last thing I'll say on this is that everything is written from the perspective of actions or activities that an attending can do to create a better learning environment for a trainee, a fellow in this case, during endoscopy. But it is a two-way street. And when you see an attending do something well on any of these sort of metrics, or as you sort of mentioned, if it's something that they're not necessarily doing so well, it's super important to feed that back to them after the scope or after the day of scoping and say, I really appreciated how you gave pressure then or fed that because I was in a tough spot, or like, I really appreciate the feedback you gave me there, or you doing that note really saved me at that moment, because these are things that really help the attendings grow as teachers. And almost 0% of gastroenterologists have been trained formally in how to teach endoscopy. They've just seen what they like and don't like. And so giving them some of that feedback is essential and very helpful to them.
Absolutely. So those are the endoscopy love languages.
They are. Let's switch to, what the people want. Yes. Dr. Winters, what are your top two love languages?
So I think, well, personally,
yes.
I think my love languages are gifts.
Okay.
And words of affirmation. It's definitely not physical touch.
Okay. To That's good to know.
Yeah.
It's a good thing we do this on Zoom.
Yeah, I know. My fiance is very pleased with our relationship. So what are yours?
Yeah. Okay. So it's constantly evolving, and it really depends on how fragile a state I am on a given day. But I will say that despite the fact that me and my now wife have been together for approximately 23 hours a day for the last 18 months, because of, the pandemic that we've mentioned on occasion, I still think my number one is quality time. I do enjoy spending time with her. And then,
from your perspective.
Yeah. Well, it's how I experience love. hers is quality time alone. But probably my other one is somewhere between words of affirmation and acts of service, depending on the day.
Yeah. Well, now our listeners know our love languages.
Yes. And
important connection with our, go ahead.
Yeah, it's all you can ask for. And I would just say, if the listeners want to share their love languages with us, the best place to do that is in the review of the podcast on Apple Podcasts or
yes,
Spotify.
Please. Yeah, and do not slide into our DMs with your love languages.
No, only with questions about interviews. And with that, I think we're done. We're going to be back with another episode at the beginning of October. We promise this time.
Yes.
And as we sign off here, we'll just give a shout out to some of our favorite fans at the University of Wisconsin under
Go Badgers.
The tutelage of the greatest of all time, Andy Coyle. Thank you guys for listening.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye, Adam.
Bye, Alex.